Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Rob?
I'm feeling self-taught. And I know for the people who are fact-checkers out there, I did do a master's for a year in history of art. So I'm not technically self-taught anymore. But for the predominant part of my life, from the age of about 11 onwards until... I think I was 29 when I did my master's. I was actually self-taught when it comes to art. And as are you, no?
Mm-hmm. Big time. I didn't have Christie's. I didn't do a master's. So I'm a legit self-taught.
You are. You're 100% self-taught, whereas I'm like 90%. but I think when I did my master's, I actually took a lot of what I'd learned myself. And that is where my passion lied, in a way, all the kind of things that I was into. But today's guest is someone who has championed and also put on exhibitions and done international art fairs with self-taught and overlooked artists. And we are so excited to be able to speak with her today, because Talk Art is not just about one type of art or one type of artist. We've always said it's art for everyone. And the more we've been doing the show, I feel like one of the great things that's come out of it is how much we're learning all the time. And I know that you went to the Outsider Art Fair in New York. Didn't you, this year?
Yeah.
Which was in January, wasn't it? Yeah. And I have experienced working with an artist that was kind of on the outside of the mainstream art world in some way, but somehow they kind of adopted her, that was Stella Vine. Do you remember, years and years ago?
Oh, yeah.
I used to help her out a lot. And she did actually end up doing a show at Modern Art Oxford. So she kind of went mainstream in a way. And I think the newspapers and, you know, media used to write a lot about her. But she was pretty much self-taught. And also her whole perspective was quite kind of, you know, on her own. And she was a really unique kind of character. I loved her a lot.
Yeah, I remember those.
And still do. I just haven't seen her in a long time. But so I feel like you and I share something with today's guest. So, which is an interest in supporting overlooked artists. So we would like to welcome to Talk Art, Jennifer Gilbert.
Hi, guys.
Hi, Jen.
Hi, Jen. How are you?
I'm all good, thanks. How are you?
Good. Where do we find you in the world?
You find me in a very rainy Manchester.
Nice. Oh, it's raining.
It Manchester. Always
what
rains in Manchester.
Yeah, exactly.
Really?
Always.
So for our listeners, you run a gallery called the Jennifer Lauren Gallery, and your name is Jennifer Gilbert. What is the Lauren?
My middle name is Lauren, so I thought Jennifer Lauren had a bit more of a catchy sound to it. So yeah.
Good one.
That's very nice. And when did you open your gallery?
So it's been running for 3 years now, but I've been working with artists in this field for a very long time.
And how did you get into this field of artists, this part of the art world?
I guess I'm an artist by trade, and I studied graphic design and illustration at St Martin's in London. And when I was at university, I found a book in the library about outsider art called Raw Creation, by John Mazels, who's the editor of Raw Vision magazine. And I think it grew from there. So my dissertation stemmed around the place of outsider art in the 21st century. And I started working with artists with schizophrenia in local community art classes, doing sessions with them and working with artists that were isolated in the community. And then I did a master's in art, health and well-being after doing a foundation in art therapy. So the place of art in people's health and well-being is really important to me, and it's a real passion of mine.
So is it a new concept for you then too? Because it feels like you were doing this because it was a passion project, and you were really interested in how people were expressing themselves through disability, through mental illness. But then you've also been able to bring these artists into like an art market arena.
Yeah, I think I mean, what I say on my website as well is that I'm a real champion for these artists, and I really want to give them a voice and platform their work. And I think because so many of them are unable to do that themselves, I really want to be that person to kind of put them out there. And I think because my background is working with disabled people, I do that in a really nurturing and sensitive way. But ultimately, I want the artist's voice to be heard, and I want it in their own words coming through so that people are really listening to them and what they have to say with their work.
That's actually something that I always really loved about the idea of being a gallerist before I was one, was this idea that you can kind of be a intermediary, you know, between like a museum or a collector and the artist, and somehow you can take the pressure off the artist, because in a way they just want to be making art. And one of the reasons we really wanted to talk to you was just because the passion that you have for, you know, facilitating and helping and promoting artists' work that we wouldn't necessarily have heard of, you know, in a kind of mainstream context. Like, a lot of the artists you show and promote aren't necessarily household names, but, you know, they definitely deserve to be because they're incredible.
Yeah, and I think it's really important what you said about being that intermediary, because I used to work for a national charity that supports kind of artists outside of the mainstream, and I was that person in between them and sort of the dealers or the buyers, because so many dealers in this field, I won't name any names, but they're out there to kind of exploit the artist and just be like, oh, I'll give you £10 for that work and I'll put it into my museum show. And for an artist that doesn't really understand things and is quite vulnerable, they get quite excited about that. But really, that work is worth so much more than £10. Yes. And I think that's why I really wanted to become this driving force, to be that person that stops this work being exploited and stop these people being exploited, and to really nurture them and, you know, take care of them and take care of the ethics of this kind of field.
Have you called anyone out in the past, and have you recognised that this was happening and you've checked it? Really?
Yes.
So what does that involve?
It happens,
I mean, how
all
do you go
the time.
About that?
Well, a lot of the time people go behind the back of like a studio or something that might be supporting an artist and go directly to the artist, and then, you know, the artist gets excited about it and gives away their work for free, or, you know, accepts that £10 for something that's taken them 3 years of their life. And then afterwards, when, you know, the studio's heard about it, it's horrendous, because then they feel really guilty that they've done it, but they didn't know anything else, because to them, it felt like the right thing to do at the time. So it happens all the time.
God. Well, thank God you're there stepping in, Jen. That's good you're there. Yeah. Well, we want to go over... there's a few things. Well, we want to cover a lot actually today, because I feel like there's so many artists that people may have heard on the periphery or that they don't know about, but there's so much exciting art and the whole outsider artist movement. But I just want to start off with the term outsider art, because I've been reading a lot of the blogs on your website, which everybody listen, you have to go to Jennifer Lauren Gallery website. And Jen talks, does a talk to the collectors and talks to artists, and you ask the same questions, like we ask the same questions, and you actually do quotes at one point, which I appreciate. Thank you very much. But you you ask the term, how people feel about the term outsider art, because it's a problematic term for many people, and it is an umbrella for a lot. But I just wanted to break down what that actually means, so people listening can understand what outsider and what self-taught and folk art really mean.
Yeah, I mean... I've done a lot of reading around this subject, obviously, and I do ask all the collectors of this art what they think of the term. But I think if we go back to where it came from, so outsider art was coined in 1972 by a guy called Roger Cardinal, and he came up with this term as to be the exact English equivalent of art brut, which was coined by a guy called Jean de Buffet in the 1940s. And the art brut itself, what that was said to mean was artwork executed by people who were untouched by artistic culture, so that they create from their own depths and not from current trends or academic rules. So they're creating for themselves and not to please other people or to gain
or
any public recognition or anything. So they didn't actually see themselves as artists, these people that were really true to this label, because lots of them lived in institutions or were completely, you know, living in their own little bubble. Whereas nowadays, it's kind of become this catch-all term, an umbrella term, meaning anyone who creates outside of the mainstream, who might be untrained or with a disability or might be socially excluded, they all just kind of get chucked under this term now. So it doesn't really mean what it was set out to mean in the first place.
Right, right.
But it's still used for things like the Outsider Art Fair and all of that. And I think one of the collectors, Randall, put it quite nicely. And he said, you know, you don't always go to a hardware store and buy hardware there. You can buy it anywhere. So you don't have to go to the Outsider Art Fair just to buy Outsider Art. You might be selling other things within that fair that aren't necessarily, right, you know, labelled Outsider Art.
Mm. Right, right.
So there's Outsider right. Art, and then the self-taught art, which is basically, you know, art produced by people that are just existing on the margins of art history and aren't taught through art school. And then a lot of American people use folk art, and folk art dates back to old traditions. So it's things that might have been passed down over the years. So it might be basket weaving or mm-hmm. stone carving or that sort of thing.
Oh, yeah, okay, we're working with wood and things like that.
Yeah, wood
like
carving.
Like a family trade type thing.
Right, like a family trade kind of thing, yeah.
Right. So why is outsider art the term for art brut? Why has art brut not remained as a constant?
Well, it was when Roger wrote this book in 1972, he wanted to call it art brut because his definition, you know, all his way of thinking about this art is the same as Dubuffet. But his publisher said, you know, you can't call it that because in English it translates as brutal art, and we can't put a book out there called brutal art. So you need to think of something else. So he banded around a few different names, and outsider art is the one that stuck.
Amazing. Right, and he's right, actually right. the person that came up with that term then.
He came up with that term, and unfortunately he's passed away now. But before he passed away, he was saying, you know, this term no longer means what I wanted it to mean. But there's been so many new terms that have kind of been flying around, and one mm-hmm. that came out in the last couple of years was Outliers, which was the name for show in America, but that doesn't seem to have really stuck at all.
What would you say would be a more include? Because outsider as a term sounds like outside, so you're not included, not inclusive.
Well, that's why people don't like it, because it makes people feel like they're on the outside. People feel like they're on the outside of society anyway, and you're saying they're kind of outsiders. Mm. And also with the term outsider art, it's like you're grouping the people rather than the art, whereas with the term art brut, you're describing the art and not the artist. So it just feels very wrong that we're labelling people that way. And with the artists on my website, I would never describe any of them as outsider artists unless they directly said to me, I want you to call me an outsider artist. So I work with a lot of artists in Japan that are working out of studios. And in Japan, it's seen as a really great thing to be classed as an outsider artist. And so they want to be known as outsider artists because it kind of puts them up on a shelf that they really like to be this kind of privileged position as an outsider rather than just being seen as a disabled artist.
Interesting.
Wow.
And actually, some of the artists that you work from Japan are the ones that Russ and I sort of first discovered, you know, like 4 months ago. I think at the beginning of this year, we started talking about them a bit. And can you speak a bit about the people you've been working with recently? Because, like, we really love Shinichi Sawada.
Yeah.
And we came to his work through Cause, because Cause likes his work.
And also,
then we posted the picture, and then... Go on. No, me and Jen, you messaged us, Jen, and then you were like, that's Shinichi Sawada. And I was like, wow. And then we started a conversation.
So cool.
And Cause was actually saying, you're amazing. And he said, you've been to the studio. You sat on that couch.
Exactly.
Where we've sat.
I've sat on that couch. Yeah. I'm a minor celebrity.
But he's a massive champion, Cause,
he's
outsider
a massive
art and
champion
artist.
He is. And it's really wonderful to see that. And the fact that he posts it for his audiences, you know, he's contemporary artist and he's posting it for his audiences to see this work. And actually lots of contemporary artists collect Sawada's work now. His work's kind of all over the world in museums and people's personal collections. And I think he came into the fore because his work was included in the Venice Biennale in 2013 in the Encyclopedic Palace. And that's when, you know, the art world suddenly woke up to this autistic Japanese artist that creates these incredible ceramic sculptures of these weird mythical kind of animal creature type forms. And he attends a studio in Japan for people with disabilities 3 or 4 times a week. And in the morning, he bakes bread, and he's been taught how to make bread because in Japan, to get your money from the government for having a disability, you have to have some sort of core skill that you do. So some people pack boxes, but he bakes bread, and other people in his studio go and sell it in the local community in the afternoon. But in the afternoons, he gets taken up in a car into the mountains, into this hut that was built for him back in early 2000s. And it's literally a shack in the middle of a... And in the middle of the mountains, surrounded by rice fields, and it's got no doors or anything to it. It's all completely open down the side, so he can only go in there when it's kind of warmer weather because it gets quite cold. And he sits in there in near silence because he's almost nonverbal, and he just sits and makes these creatures silently, sometimes with the radio on, and they take him around 4 days to make, and then they're left to dry out for 6 months in this shack. And the guy that works with him, he's built 2 wood-fired kilns there, and one goes up to 1,200 degrees and one to 800 degrees. And the 800 degrees one is the one that makes his work black. So that one's not often used for suwada. But the other one that goes to 1,200 degrees, his work goes in there for 3 days and 3 nights. So this little old man stays awake for 3 days and 3 nights feeding wood into this kiln to keep it at that temperature. And then it takes a week to cool down. And because he's a completely self-taught artist, you know, he doesn't attach things properly. So some of them explode in the kiln, some of them, you know, the leg falls off or something. And, you know, he makes so many of them. I don't think he fully understands, you know, when one breaks, he doesn't seem that bothered about it. Whereas the studio are like, oh, another one's broken. Mm-hmm. Whereas he's just quite happily making the next one. And, you know, he's fine and content to continue with what he's doing.
And does anyone know where these creatures come from? Because a lot of the artists, they create these pieces, but no one can track how they've conceive these ideas, because they're not looking at other artists, they're not looking at art history, they're not looking at movements. These things are coming from their inside their insular minds, where they're not connecting with anyone.
Completely.
And that's what's so fascinating. So you have no idea where he's conceived
no
these
idea. And because he's, you know, almost nonverbal, he doesn't obviously talk about them. The guy that works with him every day says, you know, I never get any information from him because, you know, he's not really able to speak, but you can go around this little hut with him and he might point to something and say it's a sea creature, or he'll say something is something else. And he has, when he was first making them, he had like 15 different motifs of like animal creature type things that he'd make over and over again. And since another artist joined his studio 3 years ago, his work's kind of changed more over the last 3 years. And I think he's been influenced by this guy called Contini, who has a more, he focuses more on the faces of these creatures that Contini makes. So Sawada used to cover his work in these tiny little thorns, and he was known as this guy that did these ceramics
the
covered
spikes,
in tiny spikes. And his newer work is no longer covered in these spikes. It's kind of more focused on like faces of these creatures.
It's softer edged,
and then softer lines on them instead, and less spikes. So they're taking
it's
a completely
so interesting,
different look.
Isn't it? Like the kind of power of the influence, you know, of that new artist joining the studio, but also before that, just this idea of imagination, really, and the kind of creative freedom that I think probably we all have as human beings, you know, the potential to imagine things. And maybe it's stuff from our past, even before we were even alive or something. Maybe it's like within us somehow.
But they're unedited. I mean, if you're working as an artist in the art world, I guess you edit yourself and you look at art history, but if you're not doing any of that, then what you're creating is so authentic and honest and raw, and that's what's so exciting about these artists and the fact that they now have a platform and they're seen as this with this regard of kind of a bit of magic about them. Do you feel that from the collectors and curators and audiences?
Oh, completely, yeah. And it's just the fact that he has no books or anything in this little hut. He's literally in the middle of nowhere, so it is literally coming from inside him. And you could just sit and watch him work. And it's so peaceful watching him, you know, create these pieces.
Have you met him a few times then?
I've only met him once. I went a couple of years ago to Japan and spent the day with him in the studio. I mean, obviously, he didn't really talk to me. He said hello. But I just sat and watched him work and looked around this little hut and then went back to the studio where the rest of the people were. And it was, it's just a really, it was, it just felt really peaceful watching him. And the great thing with his, him is, although he's, you know, seen as this great outsider artist, so to speak, his work is now in a museum in Germany, which is a contemporary sculpture museum, and they've just made a book about him. And this professor has written an article about him in this book, you know, describing him as this contemporary artist. And I think for the artists that I work with, I really love the fact that they're being seen now as contemporary artists and being accepted more into the mainstream for their work.
Yeah.
Yeah. And how do you manage, like, as his gallerist now, how, like, what does money mean to him? And what is his sort of family background? Is he from a wealthy family, or is the money that, because he's quite expensive now, the money that he makes on these work, does, is he aware of that? And does that go back into the family or the local community? Or
I don't think he's aware of it, you know, given the nature of his disability and the fact that, you know, he doesn't really write anything and, you know, he doesn't really speak. So I don't think he's fully aware of, you know, the popularity of his work. But his studio, certainly, you know, you walk into his studio and it's just a wall of his artwork as the thing that you walk in. So they're a really big champion of his work and really proud of, you know, where he is in the world now. But Sawada never really travels to any of the exhibitions that he does and doesn't really travel on a plane or anything. So he doesn't fully understand it, but his family are really proud of him. And so his family, you know, are the ones that receive the money and then they support him through that. But he would never not want to go to the studio. So even if he had, you know, loads and loads of money, the fact is that he loves going there almost every day to create these works. It's like a real drive for him to do it.
Amazing. It's amazing. It's amazing.
Actually, going back to New York, you know, the Outsider Art Fair this year, didn't they have an exhibition that was bringing together like collectors, kind of well-known contemporary artists?
It was contemporary artists.
The mainstream art world, yeah. Because it was fascinating to see the kind of names, because I know someone like Kors has joined the American Museum of Folk Art now on the board. Mm-hmm. So he's really sort of committing on that level as well. But the list of names was like really impressive. It was kind of like Cindy Sherman, Maurizio Catalan, Chris Martin, Kiki Smith, Nicole Eisenman, Julian Schnabel, you know, Laurie Simmons. It goes on and on and on. Mm-hmm. And I found it so interesting the way that they're all kind of successful artists in the mainstream kind of art world in a way, but how important, you know, this kind of work by self-taught and overlooked artists is to
inspires
them.
Because,
yeah, totally. Mm-hmm. Or like Polly Applebloom's a great example as well.
I guess you mean look at folk art or tribal art through the ages. Tribal art inspired a whole cubist movement.
Look at
Picasso. I mean, that was self-taught artisans crafting. That in itself could be classed as self-taught, right?
And even if you watched Grayson Perry's art program recently on the television, he talked about outsider art and that and how much it's inspired and influenced him. So,
yeah, definitely.
Mainstream people are talking a lot more about this work now.
Yeah, great. Really, well, let's talk about some of the big names that people might have heard of. For me, I would say the biggest names are Henry Darger, who... I first saw his work, and I think you saw it as well, Robert, the Museum of Everything in Primrose Hill in 2009. Yeah. And I remember seeing these panels, very disturbing, these images. He was an untrained, undiscovered guy who was a janitor, who was a bit of a hermit, and he created these worlds. And then when, on his death, they were all discovered. And now he's like, he's up there as like the granddaddy of outsider art, right?
Well, his work, you know, sold at Christie's in New York for nearly $750,000, which for an outsider artist is a lot of money. Probably, I don't know if it's the, it could be the most, but it, you know, one of his works has never sold for that much money before. So it's highly sought after work now that comes with a hefty price tag on it. But he was this, you know, shy, reclusive man in Chicago who rented this really cheap room and then worked in a hospital as a porter and created this massive body of work behind closed doors that was found just before he passed away. And he'd written this massive 15-volume epic story, which was known as the story of the Vivian girls, called The Realms of the Unreal. And it featured lots of young girls, but I think what you're saying is disturbing about them is lots of the young girls often had men's genitalia on them and were often being attacked or abused. And he often drew himself into the pictures as someone that was trying to protect the children. So there's lots of stories about his life that are floating around, and whether or not these, you know, bad things happened to him throughout his life, and whether there's all these like horrible things that you read about.
That was his therapy of creating these stories for his own sort of exorcism of whatever happened to him.
Yeah, but we don't know whether these are true or not. These are just things that are bandied about. But he used to collect magazines and newspapers, and then he'd trace the images of like girls or people out of those, and then use those tracings to do his pictures. And they were sort of like 10 meters long, double-sided in watercolor.
Huge pieces, body of work. So who
and they
who
were
gets
all
the
like hand
that?
Bound who? Down the side as
Oh,
it's incredible. But who, like, so say his auction prices, like, go for that. Who now has his estate?
He's
who looks
got
after
an estate
that?
Now.
All right.
Wow.
Wow.
Which would be a lovely thing to have.
Yes. So he's a big one. Grandma Moses. Now is she in there as some?
I wouldn't say she's as well known as them, but she. Yeah, I'd say less people know about Grandma Moses, actually. What do you know about Grandma Moses?
Well, she make they made me think of like Lowry-esque images of like quite naive people, but from her community.
Yeah.
They're kind of like they're kind of landscape, but then you see all the characters dotted around, and there's no sort of hierarchy with sizing or there's no sort of perspective on it. Everyone's just sort of the same, whether they're in the back of the field or the front by the house or whatever. But she, I thought she was quite.
I wouldn't say she's as well known as some, but she would be classed as a folk artist as opposed to an outsider artist. So there were quite naive paintings that she did of, like, you know, local rural life, potentially based from where she was living. And there's quite a few artists that kind of do that kind of style of painting. It's almost like European naive painters would fall under the same kind of bracket as Grandma Moses, I guess.
Okay. Bill Traylor, who is one that's really blown up as well. He's been incredible influence for so many contemporary artists. Now his style, and he didn't start making work until he's in his 80s, right? What's the story behind him?
Well, funnily enough, there was a Guardian article about Bill Traylor last week in England saying that there's so many forged works in his style now, which is terrible. So there's this guy that's having to go around and trying to verify them all. And in this Guardian article, there was an example of a forged version of a Bill Traylor painting. But yeah, Bill Traylor was...
You have told the difference, Jen? If you saw that,
I think when I looked at this one online, I mean, had I seen it and no one told me, no. But because I was reading this article and then I looked at it, I was like,
"Oh yeah,
I can totally see that it's not real."
Of course, it's a bit of a help, isn't it, when they say this is a forge? You're like, "Yeah."
It was the dog. I was like, "That doesn't look like a Bill Traylor dog." So I think that was a bit of a giveaway. But if you didn't know much about Bill Traylor, someone would be buying that work for a hell of a lot. And that person that painted it would be laughing. But Bill Traylor, so yeah, he's one of the biggest known outsiders. So he was born into slavery back in 1853, and he died when he was in his 90s. But he didn't actually start creating until he was 84. And he used to work on a plantation until he was 84 in Alabama, and then moved to Montgomery. And for some reason decided to start painting. And he used to live sometimes on the streets and sometimes in a storage room and a little local shop. And then he sat out all day in the African-American community in Montgomery and just sat and drew. And the main body of work that survives is from a four-year period of his life from 1939. So there was 1,500 drawings. And now they're being shown, like, David Zwimmer in New York just had an exhibition of them, which is mind-blowing, really.
Yes.
I mean, it was a beautiful exhibition.
I actually just saw a series of his work here in Margate at the Turner Contemporary, because there's an exhibition which will reopen on the 22nd of July called We Will Walk. And that's actually all that story that you just told I learnt about in sort of February time when the show opened. But yeah, it's really great to see it. So there is a chance to actually see his work here in the UK at the moment.
Yeah, which is a first, actually. It's the first exhibition of its kind in the UK. So I was due to come down to Margate to see it, but obviously lockdown stopped me seeing it.
Yeah, but you have to come in names, July, or it's on until September. I think they're extending it till the 6th of September. So
yeah, it'll be on that online.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's really, I can meet you as well, take you around. It's really amazing.
Yeah, that'd be great. But like Bill Traylor's in that, Hawkins Bold and Lonnie Holly, Mary Smith.
Yeah, Lonnie Holly, yeah.
So that would be a, you know, if you're in the UK and you want to see this work, I would recommend that. But yeah, Bill Traylor. So he was creating these works on the street, and then this guy called Charles Shannon came across his work and loved it, so bought a few of them and then wanted to kind of promote him. So when Bill Traylor was alive, he saw his work exhibited twice, and then Charles Shannon didn't show it again until the 80s. So it was kind of kept until the sort of 70s and 80s, until when back in New York, Charles Shannon did a show of it. The funny thing is that when Bill Traylor was alive, they, you know, they sold for like a dime or a quarter, and now they sell for 500,000. So I do wonder how he would feel if they were selling for so much money today in comparison.
Did he have kids
to, you know,
and family and stuff?
I'm not totally sure, actually, so I couldn't give you the answer on that, but they obviously haven't profited from it, which is a shame.
So this is what you're talking about, people taking advantage, people getting in there and sort of building these people up but taking it all for themselves.
I mean, at the time, I mean, I guess a dime or a quarter was maybe seen as a good thing back in, you know, the 40s. Right. I don't know. But, you know, now they sell for so much money. But I think what I liked about Charles Shannon is on the back of Bill Traylor's work, if Bill Traylor told him something in particular about that work, like, you know, who might be in the picture or what it was a scene on, Charles would write in Bill Traylor's dialect what was in that picture. And so some of the pieces today have got that text on the back of them, which I think is a really lovely kind of remembrance of the work, because he didn't title any of the work. So it kind of reminds people what was in it. And then I guess there was this, when I interview all these collectors, they all keep talking about this one show in America. So I had to buy this catalogue online, which cost me a small fortune because it's completely out of print.
The folk art show, right?
The folk art. So the black folk art show in America, which was in 1982.
In yeah.
People rave about this show because it was the first time African-American work had been brought together as a whole in America. And I think it was quite strange because I read something in the catalogue saying people are going to be really disturbed by this exhibition because you will have never seen any art like this in your life. And Bill Traylor had 36 works in that show. And so that was one of the things that kind of put him out there onto this platform alongside, I think it was like maybe 20 other artists in this show. So it sounded like an amazing show from reading the catalogue and from listening to
it. Is the catalogue good?
It is good, and it's got some amazing artists in it, like Bill Traylor, like William Edmondson. Let's talk about William Edmondson.
Love the work.
Yes. So he was a labourer and a farmhand, and he used to carve limestone. Again, he's from the same sort of era as Bill Traylor, so born in the 1870s, and carved these beautiful limestone sculptures. But he's someone that he was kind of, you know, walking around one day and said that he saw a tombstone appear in the sky. And then the voice of God commanding him that he had to carve. And so from that day onwards, he started to carve things. And he carved a lot of angels and a lot of religious symbolism. And when you go to the Museum of Modern Art in New York at the moment, one of his sculptures is on display there in a room that's dedicated to self-taught art alongside Bill Traylor's work.
Wow.
Which is amazing because, I mean, you know.
But they're beautiful. They are absolutely beautiful.
They are beautiful.
Sculptures.
Yeah. They're very simple carvings. They're not like delicately done. It's quite an obvious, simple shape of like an angel, but it's very beautiful to look at.
Yes.
Definitely.
One more, Madge Gill. Madge Gill seems to be like the grandmother of it all.
Our Madrigal is the most famous outsider artist in the UK. So she is, you know, for us, she is a major person to be focusing on. And she did last year have, I can't remember now, a big show at Walthamstow in the art gallery there, in the William Morris Art Gallery, had a show dedicated to her work, which was just incredible to see so much of her work brought together. But she was someone that lived in London. And she believed that she was guided by a spirit called Mine Interest. And a series of sad events in her life, like some of her children dying very young, compelled her to start wanting to do seances and to reach out to people. And then obviously this spirit guide came about and she was compelled to produce and then just didn't stop until, you know, she passed away. And she was a very, very prolific artist, like would work at night time, by candlelight, drawing on postcards over and over again, and also worked on massive rolls of calico that were sort of 35-foot long rolls of calico. Yeah. And her son made this little device that he attached the calico into, so she could only see a small bit of it at once, and then she'd roll it up and roll the next bit out. And she wouldn't ever see the thing whole until it was like out in her garden for her to see. And yet it flowed all the way along, like a really beautiful drawing. And all of her work almost always featured women's faces with a hat on. But no one ever knows who this person was, if it was the same person over and over again, if it was her, if it was her children, nobody knows.
Or something, right?
It's complete mystery, but this kind of face.
But she did this under the trance, right?
Oh, completely.
She did this because, like a trance-like state, yeah.
Yeah, because when her work was actually exhibited, it was then known as the East End Academy, which is now the Whitechapel. So when she was alive, she used to be part of their annual show, and often her long calico pieces were shown. But she said she could never sell them because they weren't hers to sell. They belonged to someone else, meaning they belonged to her spirit.
And people actually used the word visionary for her. And I think it's such a perfect description because it really is visionary. You know, it's like she sort of saw these visions in a way. And there's an amazing photograph linked to the William Morris Gallery show that we'll post on our Instagram of her with one of these giant, you know, calico artworks. So incredible.
I mean, she's classed as mediumistic as well. There's a whole big movement of the mediumistic movement is very big movement coming through that's kind of being linked to outsider at the moment. So she kind of falls underneath that.
But this is when they feel like they're making work through us through a higher being.
Yeah, she, I think she described it as a spirit guide, didn't she?
She described it as a spirit guide. Yeah.
Yeah.
Would mediumistic, would that ever involve schizophrenia artists or anyone like that are hearing voices and creating work as someone else? Or
well, it includes people like Georgiana Houghton would be described as that. She had a show at the Courthold, I think, a few years ago. Right. It's people that are being guided by other people, I guess, that would fall under that. But it's becoming very popular at the moment. It's a very, like, hot topic.
And okay, sort of, well, that's good.
At the Outsider Art Fair in Paris last year, there was lots of dealers that had mediumistic art on their stands that they were selling. So it's kind of like, you know, the hot thing to buy at the moment.
Well, that's an insider-outsider tip, isn't it? You've just given us, Jen. Outsider insider tip. So, well, let's talk about some of the artists that you have on your rosters. We talked about Shinichi Sawada, the guy from Japan, and now there's an amazing artist who I look at his work and the thought of making it myself gives me a migraine. Pradeep Kumar. If I had to concentrate like he concentrates making these things, I would have a migraine. His skill. Let's talk about him.
He's so meticulous. It kind of takes it to a whole other level.
Yes,
meticulous, and they're so delicate in the flesh. Like when he carves the little legs onto the matchstick of the birds, they're so thin. Like I almost don't want to pick it up because I feel like it's just going to snap off. And he's just sent me his father's just sent me some pictures of some new ones he's done. So he carves toothpicks and matchsticks, and then he carves the very tip of them into, it's normally people or birds and animals. And his father's just sent me two of people in yoga positions upside down on their hands. They're so
out of the toothpick. Oh my
out
god!
Out of a toothpick, like, and it's literally like the bit that he actually carves is like a centimeter long, and the detail in them when he paints them afterwards, like with a little necklace or like a little chain around their waist or buttons down their top, it's just insane.
How did you find him? How did you discover his work?
His work, so Raw Vision often shows his work at the art fairs, and I saw it there, and I've seen his work in lots of exhibitions about outsider art. And so Raw Vision put me in touch with...
What is Raw Vision? That's a gallery, isn't it?
No, Raw Vision is the only outsider art magazine that exists in the world, so I recommend everyone should buy this magazine. It comes out 4 times a year and has articles about different artists in it. So Sawad has had an article about him, Pradeep's probably had an article about him, you know, lots of these big artists, Bill Traylor, they've all had articles about them written in Raw Vision magazine. So it's
so you can discover new artists magazine. In this magazine if you're looking for new talent.
I don't think I could discover new artists in there. People who find new artists will want to have an article about that artist in there to kind of get them known wider.
Right.
I mean, for
that's
me,
that's the kind of go-to magazine.
That's a go-to if you want to learn more about this. Definitely, I'd recommend that. The way I find artists is either some people approach me or I approach studios. If I see some artists that I like online or if I visit exhibitions or different studios around the world, I'll pop in and see the artists there, or some people recommend people to me. So there's lots of different ways that new artists would come around.
And actually, you yourself are introducing us and many other people across the world to so many different artists. And the show that you did in January, or earlier this year anyway, in London, Monochromatic Minds. Can you talk a bit about that? Because I know you're about to start a whole Zoom series of talks in July. So I thought it would be interesting for people to hear about the original premise of the show.
Yeah, so through my gallery, I like to do pop-up shows. And normally they're quite small because I have quite a limited budget. So I managed to get some funding from the Arts Council, which was not enough to cover the exhibition, but enough to help me put it on. And I decided I only ever buy black and white artwork myself. And so I really love intricate black and white artwork. And so I wanted to put on a show of monochrome work from around the world. And it was 61 artists working in black and white that are self-taught, disabled or classed as outsider artists. And it was people working out of studios and people that just exist and are isolated in community and work by themselves. Some of them I knew, some people were suggested to me. And then I pulled together this exhibition and I held it at Candid Arts Trust in London. And it was only on for a very short time because it's so expensive to hire spaces out in London. So it was on for 10 days.
Did you have work by the Japanese artist Haku Nagawa?
I did, yes.
Because I love that artist so much.
It's a she.
I love her work so much.
It's a she. Yeah, she's quite got quite severe mental health issues, but she draws on like sort of postcard-sized white paper with a black pen. And draws whatever pops into her head. So, I mean, I've got a drawing by her of a face and it's got four eyes on the face and there's kind of snakes coming out of the eyes. It's quite weird. Wow. And sometimes they look like quite friendly little characters. Sometimes they look like quite disturbed characters. There's one that's riding a bike, waving, but they're just pen and ink drawings, really small, you know, quite detailed drawings. So there was pieces like that in there. And then there's pieces by a British artist called Nick Blinko, who's a very well-known artist for having schizophrenia, but also for being the lead singer of a punk band called Rudimentary Penai. So he's got this massive cult following that follow him, and he always draws all his album covers and everything. And I had a magnifying glass next to his work in the exhibition because the detail in it is just ridiculous. And so some people just came just to see his work because they're super fans, but they'd look at one piece of his work for like an hour because there's so much detail in it. So much detail. So I had people like him. And then on the flip side of that, I had someone like Donald Mitchell, who works out of Creative Growth in California, mm-hmm. that draws these like people with a black body and just a white circular head with eyes, nose and a mouth, and they're all stacked on top of each other, and it's a very simple, playful image, but they're just beautiful. And oh. you know, he doesn't need to do anything else, so there's like complete opposites in this exhibition, and it was artists from all over the world.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, this is Russell Tovey and Robert Diamond from Talk Arts, the arts podcast, and we're here today with Budweiser beer, and we're going to be talking about something very, very important to both of us, aren't we, Rob?
That's right. Budweiser, the king of beers, has joined forces with legendary artist Sir Peter Blake, the godfather of British pop art and someone that both of us have adored since we were kids.
I've loved pop art since I was a kid, and Sir Peter Blake has been a constant for me, alongside other pop art artists, the Americans like Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, Keith Haring. And I got into pop art, Rob, because I loved cartoons growing up. I mean, I still love animation. But suddenly I discovered that so many artists were referencing comic strips and cartoons in their artworks, and I could go and see them in museums, and I suddenly didn't need to grow up. And Sir Peter Blake was one of these artists that meant so much to me. And I think people, if they don't know the name Sir Peter Blake, you would certainly know his work. The album cover for The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, Oasis's Stop the Clocks. These are iconic art historical moments that this artist has actually been at the forefront of.
And you've met him, haven't you?
I've met him, at the South Bank Show Awards years ago. I was there for the History Boys, and he was there, and I got incredibly excited and met him. But you've not met him before, have you, Rob?
I have. I've actually even been to his house and hung out with him and his wife, and I got to make an amazing print with him, which was a huge privilege, actually. It was a real career moment for me. So Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake have come together to unite, and they have created an exclusive limited edition beer can, which doubles as a collectible piece of pop art.
And it was on display at London's Truerman Brewery on the 23rd and 24th of March this year, if you were lucky enough to get there. And also, were you one of the lucky few that were able to get one of the signed beer cans by Sir Peter Blake himself? And there was something very special there, wasn't there, Rob? What was that?
They've actually made the first ever fridge frame, which kind of is reminiscent of what we would be, you know, accustomed with in terms of a museum exhibit. Yeah. But this fridge frame is designed to display the limited edition can of beer as a work of art, but also keeps the beer cool.
Okay, I need a fridge full of fridge frames because this sounds incredible. So Peter Blake's work adorns the cans with all of his eye-catching simplicity. It features the Budweiser's iconic red bow tie logo, but it's encompassed by the artist's signature and his use of block colours and icons. They unveiled this artistic can in all of its glory in one of these fridge frames, as Rob said, which is very exciting. The limited edition cans are available to purchase as a four-pack for a limited time only in selected Tesco stores nationwide.
Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake, thank you for bringing us this cultural moment. I love it when art reaches new audiences, and I really feel like this is going to go into everyone's homes, and it's really joyous. So head over to Tesco, pick up a four-pack. Thank you, Budweiser.
But also, if you want to get this collectible piece of art at home, Budweiser also giving people the chance to own their very own exclusive fridge frame. Beer and art lovers can register their interest by visiting www.budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. That's budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. Budweiser and Talk Art with Sir Peter Blake.
So it was wonderful.
What's creative growth?
Creative Growth is an art center in California, and it's right. I think in America it's the one that's been going the longest working with artists with developmental disabilities. So you should Google them because they have some incredible artists there. So Judith Scott came out of there, and Judith Scott is, you know, now celebrated across the world for her fiber sculptures, and had a solo show at Brooklyn Museum and was shown in the Venice Biennale. They also have Dan Miller that works out of there. He's very famous in the outsider field. But his work was shown at the Andrew Edlin Gallery at Frieze in New York last year. And I think they sold out on the first day. And this is somebody with a developmental disability. And he does these massive works of overlapped text. And again, he's someone who's quite nonverbal, but just writes words over and over again on top of each other to build up these really beautiful drawings with pen and with paint. And some of them are, you know, huge, and then some of them are quite small. And he had this beautiful display at Frieze in New York last year, and they just flew out. And his work's now, you know, with lots of contemporary artists again in their homes and their collections.
That's so cool. One of my, and actually Frieze did a whole kind of installation, didn't they? Like an exhibition within the fair.
That was
in
last
New York.
Year, yeah.
Well, that was last year, Doors of Perception, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And Sawada was part of that.
I was going to say, Sawada was in that, wasn't it?
Yeah. Which was well exciting because, you know, I got really to go exciting. To Frieze in New York.
Yeah.
Which was amazing.
You know, in your show, in the monochromatic show, one of the favourite artists for me was Davoud Kouchaki.
Mm-hmm.
Who sadly has recently passed away, but
he
actually said on your Instagram that he was the smiliest artist ever.
He was.
Because he was always smiling. I love his work and I love him. What an amazing energy.
He's always so happy. And again, someone that didn't start drawing till he was in his 60s, so, you know, later in life. And he's known as the Pencil Man. And he drew these incredible creatures, but I had this one in my exhibition and it was like a large kind of mound of a creature in the middle and then these four smaller ones either side. And he said that they're all huddling around the big main one because he was protecting them and looking after them. And I was like, oh my God, that description is so nice. And it's in, and no, and that was a huge drawing. It was sort of A1 size. And then he goes down to sort of A4 size. And again, his work's all over the world in many people's collections. And, you know, lots of the time they were quite smiley, these, you know, they might have looked a bit scary, but they often have a smile on their face. So you kind of like, is it scary? Should I be happy? I'm not sure.
Is that a sinister smile or is that a smile? Yeah.
But if you see photos of him, then, you know, you just think, oh, I must be happy.
Yeah, we'll post some of him because I love him.
Yeah.
You were talking about non-verbal artists. There is an artist actually who's making a big splash at the moment who is a contemporary artist called Marlon Mullen, who was in the Whitney Biennial, and he's completely seen as the mainstream, and his work is incredible. Can we talk about him for a bit? Do you know a lot about his work?
Yeah, I really like his work, actually. So I only found out about it a couple of years ago when I saw it at in the New York gallery called JTT, and he's also represented
Jasmine's
by Adams and Ullman in Oregon.
Yes. Yeah.
But he's a black artist who's pretty much nonverbal and autistic, and he's in his mid-50s, and he works out of somewhere like Creative Growth, but it's called NIAD in California, which is like a sister. There's three in California that are all linked, so that one's linked in. And he does these massive, they're quite often massive, massive paintings with really simplified imagery on them. So he takes photographic images from magazines, from lifestyle magazines, contemporary art magazines, or the front covers of them, and then he appropriates it and abstracts it in his mind into this reduced version of shapes and lettering and stuff, and does this completely unique version of that kind of cover or image that he's using. So like you said, he was in the Whitney Biennial last year, and also the San Francisco MoMA gave him an award last year. And for both of those occasions, he's the first disabled artist working out of a studio that's ever been included in that biennial or been given that award by MoMA, which is a massive turning point for disabled artists being accepted into the contemporary art world more. And it's just, he's on this like real path. Oh, it's so long overdue, but he's on this massive path at the moment of like amazing things coming his way.
But he's quite, I think he is aware though, isn't he? He is aware because I think he was at the Biennial and stuff.
Yeah, and he had a jacket on that said Whitney Biennial on the back of it, which was amazing. But he goes to visit all these things, and although, you know, he might not be there to speak or anything, he's taking in the atmosphere and people are coming up to him and, you know, telling him how incredible his work is. So, yeah, he's someone I think understands what's going on.
We were talking to Catherine Bradford the other day, and she was saying that now, you know, I think the last kind of 5 years, you know, maybe decade, but I think really the last 5 years, people are just so much more interested in kind of new ways of seeing the world, and also like marginalized voices and people that haven't had platforms on so many levels, whether it be you know,
people
that are
outside
artists,
the mainstream,
or people of color or queer voices or all these different voices. And I think it's so so important that you know, that includes, you know, disabled artists or self-taught, you know, all this kind of other field as well.
I agree, but I think that our country is so far behind everywhere else. Like in America, this work is celebrated, you know, it's talked about by art critics all the time. Like the New York Times writes about these artists all the time and praises them for, you know, their incredible work. You've got MoMA that's got a room dedicated to them and other pieces dotted around their collection. And then you look at England and you think, what the hell's going on here? When you see things written about these exhibitions, it's always like, come and meet the misfits, and like really negative articles about these artists, which is not really encouraging people to go and see it.
It's not said that. That's not a real quote, is it? That hasn't been said.
Adrian Searle, the headline was Meet the Misfits. And then he said, oh God, I wish I could remember what it said now. But, he said that the exhibition left him disturbed. And I just thought, you're not really encouraging people to go and see these exhibitions. That was a show that was at the Whitechapel a few years ago.
Yeah, that was 2006, wasn't it?
Yeah, but you just think, and then you look at what people like Roberta Smith and Jerry Saltz write in America, and they're like, you know, praising this work. Our art critics are like destroying it. And I think because there's so few exhibitions of this work, it kind of pops up. So, you know, you had the 2006 show. In 2013, you had The Alternative Guide to the Universe at the Haywood, which again was panned in the press. You had a Japanese Outsider Art Show at the Welcome, which got quite a lot of good press, actually. And then, you know, you've got this exhibition at the Turner Contemporary now, and then a few, you know, higgledy-piggledy things dotted around, but you don't really have anything that's there all the time for people to see. Like, the Tate doesn't have, you know, specific pieces of this work that they have out for people to kind of gain more understanding of outsider art.
Why do you think that is here? Do you think that's because the gallery system in the States, like you had big galleries like Phyllis Kind was a hero for promoting outsider art, folk art, self-taught artists. You seem to be like a hero in the UK, Jen. You're like, you're going to get awards. You need like services to the arts,
totally,
MBE, CBE,
totally.
all the letters. But who, I mean, do you think it's because there isn't that
I think
foundation
it's because we don't we don't have it in this country. We don't, and in lots of the other places, like in Paris, you've got the House Saint Pierre, which is a museum pretty much dedicated to showcasing outsider and self-taught art. In Lausanne, in Switzerland, is where Jean Dubuffet's collection is housed. In America, I mean, in New York alone, you've got so many individual galleries like Andrew Edlin, Scott from Shrine, Kevin Morris. They're all showcasing this kind of work alongside bigger places like the American Folk Art Museum. And then you come to England and, you know, we've got the Gallery of Everything in London, which showcases this work but hasn't been there that long. But really, we don't have a place where you can see this work all the time and appreciate it, and for people to understand it more, to then, you know, want to see more of it. So when
we have the studios.
So true.
Do we have studios, though?
We do have studios, yeah. But again, right. I'd say the studios in America, like Creative Growth and Land Gallery in New York, I mean, they seem, because they've been going a long time, but they seem to do a lot of high profile art fairs as well, or things like the Outsider Art Fair. But like Creative Growth takes part in like Art Paris, and they do an art fair in LA. Is it the Felix Art Fair, maybe? Something beginning with F, can't remember. But they seem to have more of a platform, whereas our studios don't seem to have that same platform, and again, don't seem to have that same recognition that studios in other countries seem to have. So it just, it makes me really sad that this country just doesn't have this like amazing following, because there's so many amazing artists that work out of this country, and they just seem to get lost unless, you know, I put on a pop-up exhibition, and I can't do that all the time because, you know, I can't afford to do that all the time.
No,
but
of course.
I just love
you on your
for
own
people
in this
to
world,
see it
in this field.
Yeah, completely on my own.
So what is your What do you think should happen now then? What can we do? What needs to be in place? What is the infrastructure to get this more exposure and to have it more respect? And
well, I'd like to see, and I'd like to make it happen, a museum that showcases this kind of work and has like a permanent display, you know, potentially rotating.
Collection.
And then brings in touring shows. So if you look at somewhere like Gugging, which is in Vienna in Austria, is where the House of Artists is. And the House of Artists was set up by Dr. Leo Navratil, and he had patients on his ward, and he would encourage them to draw. And then it was an all-male ward. And then he pulled people off that he saw had really great potential and put them all together in the House of Artists where they could create and be looked after for, you know, their mental health needs. And now next to this beautiful House of Artists where they've all painted all over the outsides of it and everything, is the Gugging Museum and the Gugging Gallery. So the museum is upstairs and it has two shows a year of really high profile shows about outsider art, or one artist in particular from the outsider art field, or shows the Prinzhorn collection. And then downstairs is a studio that the artists who live in the house can come over and use whenever they want. And then there's the Gallery Gugging, which is run by a lady called Nina. And they do more like six shows a year, and they're showing work out of that studio and putting it together with other people like Miss Ladies that you said you liked from Cuba.
Yeah, I've just acquired a work, Miss Ladies Castilla Pedrosa, who's amazing.
Yes, she's got some work there alongside Oswald Schertner at the moment in the gallery downstairs. So they're kind of pairing the two against each other. So they have artists from the House of Artists alongside artists from out in the world. In the field as well. So I feel like we need that, but here. And I'd like to make that happen one day.
But it's true, isn't it? Because like one of the only times I really remember seeing a kind of complete exhibition, well, actually, apart from We Will Walk as well, because that has a lot of...
It looks amazing,
yeah. But it was Museum of Everything when it used to be in Chalk Farm.
Yeah.
Yeah,
like that was just a pop up again. Yeah. That was never
exactly,
going
but it was
to
also
stay.
It was also financed by a private individual again. It's not
completely, yeah.
Yeah, and the thing is, the audience for this is huge, you know, for art generally. So, like, if someone helps to actually, I don't know, create a wing in a leading museum, or which should really happen as well, I think, you know, as well.
Well, that's happened.
Totally.
In Lam in Lille has got an outsider art wing.
Exactly. But like there will be crowds of people there because people are interested. Do you know what I mean? And
there's a
fascination with the brain as well.
Really? But isn't it just about education though? Isn't it about...
Oh, it's definitely about education. Like this whole field just seems to be completely written out of art history. And I'd love it if art schools would start talking about the outsider art movement and the self-taught and folk art and educate people when they're at art school, because it's never talked about. And so people just, you know, like me, I happened across it in a book in the library, and that's how I found out about it. Like, no one at art school ever talks about it.
And actually, it's interesting that a lot of the champions of you know, self-taught work has been other artists because they've got curious minds, or and also collectors, actually, because collectors also have a curiosity and they want to research things and learn things. It's really interesting, actually. Well, we definitely want to include, you know, a whole chapter about the work that you're doing in our talk art book as well, because you know, I think we all have to start doing things to, you know, give as much platform as you can to different voices.
Yeah, inclusivity and you know, break down art labels and just kind of get this out there. But let's talk about you, Jen. We've talked about all the artists, but you, as well as being a trailblazer and a hero, you are also a trustee for the Barrington Farm Trust in Norfolk, which is supporting learning disabled artists. How long have you been involved with that? And again, hero, you're going to have so many letters after your name. Tell us about Barrington Farm Trust.
Barrington Farm's amazing. It's based in Walcott in Norfolk, kind of about 5 minutes from the sea. And it's a working farm. So some of the people there don't do art, and they actually work on the farm and help with, you know, when the baby animals are born and everything, they feed the animals and they help to rear them and everything. And then there's a barn there, and the barn has an art studio in it, which is an incredible space with a kiln in it. And the artists are free to do, as in many studios, do whatever they want. So there's one guy called Michael Smith who quite often is found cutting up pieces of fabric and sticking them back together again with bits of masking tape and winding and winding and winding until things are completely covered. And then he'll just hang it up and move it on to the next thing. And then also, so there's the art barn. Then they have another part of it where sometimes they do exercise classes, they might play boccia. So it's almost like a day centre with an art section and then a farm, because lots of the people that attend with learning disabilities, the ones that are more able live in little cottages on the site. So three of them might live together in a cottage, and then they have a carer that comes in and supports them. And then they have a home on site for the people that have more severe disabilities, and then they have 24-hour care, and then those people are taken over to kind of the art barn to create art whenever they want to go and create it. And so it's been going for years and years. I think since the 80s it's been going, and it's, you know, it's quite a small place and not many people will have heard of it, and not many people visit the space because it's kind of very remote where it is. But they have some really incredible artists that come out of there, and one of them had some work in Norwich Art Museum, and he got, it was in like an open exhibition, and he had this really huge textile piece. He does hand embroidery, this guy called James Gladwell. And he was selected from all these artists to win the top prize, which for him was just amazing. You know, just a learned disabled artist that works out of this studio won the top prize and won, you know, some money, and he was due to have a show there. So it's just a really wonderful place. It's a wonderful place to be involved with. And I've been a trustee there maybe for about 3 years, but I've known about them a lot longer than that, and I'm really good friends with them now as well. So it's...
What does being a trustee, what does that involve?
I think in comparison to other places, because it's very small, we don't do as much as other trustees of very big, powerful organisations might. But you have to read through kind of financial reports, and they suggest different things they might want to do, and you have to okay them and okay if they want to spend money on things, and checking in on, you know, health and safety, risk assessments. It's not all glamour. Lots of reading.
Yes.
Yeah, and it's a lot of listening.
But important,
isn't it?
And a lot of listening, yeah. And thinking what's best for the art barn and for the artists that attend there, and thinking about different opportunities that you can kind of get them into as well. So, yeah, it's great.
Awesome.
Amazing. You had a show in April that you had where you put out a 2-week call out. I think that's when we connected, because... I was following you anyway, and I think we talked after we went to Core Studio and we saw the pictures, but there was a show called Unlocked Unearthed, where you were looking for artists that defined themselves as disabled or deaf to submit an artwork. And you were trying to find a lot of deaf artists, weren't you?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've just done some research with some money I got from the Arts Council into kind of what is and isn't out there for disabled and deaf artists. And through talking to some deaf artists recently, and I was supporting a deaf artist with an Arts Council application as well, it occurred to me that, you know, there's barely any information in BSL that these, you know, these artists can ever access any opportunities, because there's nothing out there that explains the opportunities to them in a way that they can understand. So not
that's
only
British
was,
Sign Language, BSL,
yeah, British,
isn't it?
Yeah.
British,
so yeah. Not yeah. Yeah. So not only was it I was looking for disabled, I was trying to target deaf artists by having interpretation done by someone I know, so that I could target those people. So it was really lovely that I was getting applications and queries from deaf artists to be included in that exhibition. So when I put the exhibition out online afterwards, I again got this interpreter to reinterpret the text I'd written about the exhibition into BSL, so that the people selected that were deaf could again understand what I'd written about, you know, the exhibition putting out there. So like I said, I don't just do my gallery stuff, because although it's my main passion, I can't live off, you know, I'm not one of these big dealers that's been going for years. I'm a small newcomer dealer of the new generation of young dealers working in this field. And because I've only been going for 3 years, I don't have enough money to warrant doing it full time. So I work as a freelance producer and curator with disabled and deaf artists. And so this call out was aimed at those to kind of put their work out there more and give them something to look forward to during lockdown. So, you know, everyone was in doom and gloom. I work with a lot of very vulnerable artists, and lots of them were told, you know, you have to stay in, you can't leave the house for, you know, 12 weeks or whatever. Yeah. And lots of them became quite depressed, and I wanted to do something to give people, you know, something to look forward to share with their friends. You know, my work is on this website, it's in this scene. Isn't that a wonderful thing that's happening at the moment? And so, that was the reason I wanted to do that.
Jen, you're a wonderful feedback. Thing.
We love
you're
that.
A wonderful
Thank
thing.
You.
This is
your
this is
fans.
Like, and also, yeah, and you help people with their applications. You go out of your way to assist people who are like confused by the whole process. That's something that you offer,
so I'm working with an organization in London at the moment, just doing a bit of freelance work for them, and I've just written like an easy read version of their application, because for me, like, inclusivity and people being able to understand information is so important to me. So I don't ever write things with, you know, any art jargon or any big words, because I want the kind of text on my website to be understood by a lot of people. So when I was working with this organization, I said, you know, it would be really great if we put your application form into Easy Read, which is like really simplified text with images next to it that kind of show what the text is doing, so that someone with a learning disability or someone that can't take in long panels of text could read that and then would still be able to submit without having to ask too many extra questions. So making things as inclusive as possible is like a real big passion of mine, and making it so that everyone, making it accessible. So like with my Monochromatic Minds exhibition, I spent so long in London looking for an accessible venue, because so many venues do not have ramps to get into, which is just absurd in this day and age. And then once I found one, you know, with a ramp, I then did like an audio tour of the exhibition, because I work with people with visual impairments and I wanted them to be able to, you know, get something more from the exhibition rather than, you know, just coming and chatting to people. So I did an audio tour that they could listen to. And then I did a film, and I subtitled the film with five of the artists, because I wanted people to hear from the artists that were in the exhibition, you know, what does art mean to you? Why do you do it? Share with people, you know, where this comes from inside you. So I had this little like 10-minute film on repeat in the show, and then I got some of the artists to give talks, and one of the artists traveled down from Edinburgh, and he's called James Allison, and he attends a studio in Edinburgh, and he came down and took part in the talk, and he's never done anything like that in his life, and you know, he's got a learning disability, and he prepared this little speech, and he got up, and you know, it was a very simple speech, you know, I like art, I like drawing birds, I like drawing trees, you know, I like the color blue. And then he got to the end and everyone clapped and he sobbed, and he just went, I'm so proud of myself for doing that. And I was like, we're all so proud of you. And it was just a really magical moment that he was able to travel down to talk about his work in front of just a general art audience. They weren't people, you know, that have all just come from the disability arts field. There was people from all walks of life that had come to listen to him speak. And it was just such a wonderful moment to hear that. And then, I mean, he set me off and I was like, I can't talk again now.
I've got tears in my eyes now. He's saying that story.
He draws really beautiful, simple pictures of birds. They're amazing.
Awesome.
Well, you know what? Next time you have a show, Jen, I would be up for doing the audio tour if you tell me what to say.
That'd
if you give
be
me
amazing.
A script, I'll voice the audio tour for you. I'd absolutely love that.
That'd be amazing.
I think that would be really exciting.
Definitely.
Oh,
it might make more people come to my show.
Yeah, well, we've got to. This has got to happen. There's an artist you work with called Terence Wilde. Who describes himself, or you describe his work, he's an adult survivor. Now, what does that term actually mean? And is that used to describe a lot of artists of a certain
I'd say a lot
way?
Of people would describe themselves as adult survivors. I mean, he was someone that was abused as a child. And he suffers from post-traumatic stress disorder because of that, and also has mental health issues. So he calls himself an adult survivor. And so I use that description because he uses that description to describe himself. But his work's incredible. His work was in my show, but he's also someone that I represent 25 artists in total, and he's one of the artists that I represent more fully, as opposed to the people that were just within that black and white show. Mm-hmm. And so I've just done a series of mini interviews with artists that I support on my website as well, and he was mm-hmm. the first one that I did, and I was asking them, you know, what have you been doing in lockdown? And I was like, oh, based on talk art, you know, what's and then took something, you know, what have you been doing? You know, what's your new skill and stuff? So I've been doing that with each of the artists, but Terence, I've known him for years and years. And as soon as I set up my gallery, I was like, really want you to come on board with me. And he was like, of course, Jen. And I really champion what he does, because he creates these really incredible, really detailed work. And he has two sides to what he does. So he does this colourful work that he says is like his money-making work. I mean, he doesn't sell it for a lot of money. It sells between, you know, £50 to £200. But it's money that, you know, he makes, and he knows it's more likely going to sell than his black and white work, which is the work that I obviously prefer. But his black mm-hmm. and white work is all to do with his mental health and what's happened to him throughout his life, and often has quite negative things put into it, or wording or negative drawings and sayings and things. And I think it's really powerful work, and that's why I love to show that work, because not because I'm trying to like scare people, but there's lots of people in his position that don't want to talk about it or think they're alone. And I think by sharing his work, it's and lots of people said that about the film, because he was in the film in my exhibition. He was sharing something about himself, and lots of people could relate to that, and they thought they were alone. And after watching the film, they realized they're not alone in what they've been through and what, you know, what they go through on a daily yeah. basis. And Terence is someone that's quite open and talk about that. So he's someone that, you know, I love to work with quite a lot, because he's very generous in sharing what's happened so that it can somehow help other people along the way.
Oh, wow. Amazing.
And also he works in a hospital with other people with mental health issues and runs art workshops for them. And I think he says that's really great, because when they say something to him about how they're feeling, he says, I know exactly how they're feeling because I've been there myself, and they really relate to me in that manner. So, yeah.
Jen. All right.
I feel like I've depressed you.
No, you haven't. You've inspired. This is really an amazing chat. You're an incredible... incredible woman.
I wanted to ask Rob. Oh, can I just quickly ask Rob? Rob, have you been to the Shell Grotto in Margate?
Yeah, I love it. I've been a number of times.
Good. Yeah, mate, I didn't know whether you'd ever heard of it or not, because that would be classed as like an outsider environment.
Yeah, totally. And actually, they used to have seances in there.
Yeah.
There's photographs of a seance actually currently mm-hmm. like wallpapered on the wall in there. Mm-hmm. And it made me think of the artist you were talking about earlier, you know, this idea of like spirit guides and
yeah.
And Tracy Emin is a big fan of it, and she's referenced it in her work. And she's also done a little podcast with Jem McKerney, who lives here in Margate. But I love it, and I make every single person that visits Margate that I know.
I still haven't been there, Rob. I still haven't been there.
Hasn't. It's Russell.
It's me. But do we know the artist who did it, or is it like a secret thing?
Was that a
thing that's discovered?
It's like 180 years old, isn't it? But I think there's not much known about the history. It says like there's all these different stories, and it's kind of been muddled over the years. And I don't think anyone ever knows the true story anymore about, you know, how it started and why
it could well be tourism, really. Or it could be, there's loads of, you know, ideas about it.
Yeah.
But it is really impressive. And it's actually the kind of thing that Russell is going to go crazy for.
He hasn't
been there yet, but next time.
I think I've always got the dogs, so I feel like it's actually three dogs in the Shell Grotto.
The last two or three times, he's had like three dogs with him. They're giant, almost bigger than me. So
I don't know what they'd be like around shells everywhere. Jen, we ask every guest coming on some really exciting questions.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is, if you could do an art heist, if you could steal nicely any work of art in the world all for yourself, what would it be and why?
See, mine's quite obscure. I've been thinking about this, but Ever since I saw it, I've loved it. There's an artist in the Prinzhorn collection, which is in Germany, which is a collection of pieces from institutions. And there's an artist called Agnes Richter who did this little embroidered jacket. It's called the Little Jacket, and it was embroidered in 1895. And there's barely anything known about this artist other than the fact that she was in this institution and was born in the 1840s, I believe. And so she has this little jacket, and it's like, I believe it was a straight jacket that she's cut up and made into like a little peplumed jacket. And then she's stitched all over it with thread that apparently came from her socks, but who knows? And stitched all over it biographical information. So on the sleeves of the jacket, the text is all on the outside, but on the actual jacket itself, it's all on the inside. And because it's so old, it's kind of half of the, you can't really read what it says, and I don't think it made much sense in the first place. But it's just a really beautiful art, a piece that I saw in an exhibition there called Madness is Female, and it's stunning. It's a stunning piece of work, and they won't let it tour anymore because it's so fragile and it's so old, so it has to stay in the collection. So everyone should Google that, because it's a beautiful, I mean, I couldn't ever do it. I'd have to put it in the corner and never touch it.
But, and also, but it's what a I loved, miniature jacket, like a doll's
she used to wear it. It's human size. Like a straight jacket cut up into, you know, a jacket. And apparently she used to wear it. But when I was at university doing my degree, you had to do a piece to get a visual piece to go alongside your dissertation. And because my dissertation was about outsider art, I did my own interpretation of this little jacket. So I made a Victorian petticoat, cut it up and made it into a blouse, and then stitched all over about this Victorian lady's life who then suffered a breakdown and did all that sort of stuff. And in 2011, my embroidered shirt was hung alongside this shirt in the Prinzhorn collection in Germany, which was exciting.
That's so cool.
So that
Where is it now, Jen? Is it now the tour? It's left the original behind. Now that's doing the tour, the new life.
Mine's like tucked away in a drawer somewhere.
We will
congratulations.
We will definitely post an image of Agnes Richter's jacket, but also we need to get an image of yours.
Your jacket. Yeah. With you wearing it.
And I could never fit my arms in it. I made it too thin on the arms, so I could never
And was it from your own straitjacket? Or was it?
Yeah, obviously. No, I just made a petticoat to begin with, and then cut the petticoat up and made it into a Victorian style blouse.
Awesome.
So no.
Wow.
Well, the next question we ask every guest is very simple. What is your favourite colour?
I'd have to say black, which, you know, is that a colour? Is it not a colour? I don't know. But I'm very pale. I'm very pale with red hair, so I have to wear quite dark, bold colours, I feel.
Oh, really?
Otherwise, I just look like a ghost. So I live in a lot of black. Not so much green, mainly navy blue and black. Not very exciting on the colour front there.
Is that the black and white theme for your collection? Yeah,
I feel maybe that's what, you know, comes through in my work as well.
And you share that favourite colour with Jonathan Lyndon Chase, who we interviewed recently, because their favourite colour is black as well, and they actually painted the bedroom completely black as well,
black,
which I thought was very cool.
Yeah. I think that might be a bit scary.
I don't know. I think they feel safe. It's horses for courses.
So even though we're not asking everyone at the moment, because lockdown's kind of basically beginning to end now, but what is a hidden skill that you found during lockdown, as you've referenced it on your own blog?
Have I? Oh, yeah, the question. I thought you meant I've referenced it myself. I've been thinking about this as well. There was two things I'd say there were skills. One of my friends teaches clay classes, and each week she's been dropping a kilogram of clay off and a worksheet in order to make something out of clay, which has been amazing. So I've made a salt pig, I've made a jug, I've made a pinch pot.
Wow.
Then she takes them away and fires them and then asks you what colour glaze you want on them and then glazes it and then brings it back to your house again. So I've got a lovely little collection of clay objects.
That is very
The other thing is...
Is she doing that for everyone or just you? Is this a thing?
No, you had to pay. It was like £5 each week for clay. Anyone could sign up to it. Yeah, it was amazing.
This is in Manchester?
This is in Manchester, yeah. She's called Sarah Crosby.
And then
the other thing is I normally would go to Lindy Hop classes each week, which is Lindy Hop is like, you know, 1920s Charleston
wartime
dancing.
Yeah.
And so I've been doing online classes, learning things like the Tranky Do and the Shim Sham, which are like jazz routines. So I've been dancing around my living room, learning jazz routines.
Oh, that's classic.
Oh my God. You are inspiring on every single level. There's another artist I do want to talk about before we go that makes me want to go to India. When we were talking, mm-hmm. we were talking about an artist called Nek Chand. Mm-hmm. And he is known for creating the second most visited tourist attraction in India behind the Taj mm-hmm. Mahal is the Chandigarh Rock Garden. Can we talk mm-hmm. a bit about that and how long you've been working with his estate? Or did you actually work with him when he was still alive? I don't know.
Well, Nek Chand, yeah. So he's an Indian artist who lived to the ripe old age of 91. So he only died maybe like 4 or 5 years ago. And mm-hmm. when he was 34 years old, he was working as a road inspector in India. And then he decided to one day, he found this like plot of land behind a wall and so started collecting some river stones in different shapes and sizes and different bits of materials he could find, bits of broken pot and everything. And then for 18 years, he worked in secret to build what is now known as the Rock Garden of Chandigarh, which is now, you know, 40 acres in size and has over 2,000 sculptures in there. And he built it all by himself for 18 years. And then once it was found, the authorities, you know, originally wanted to get rid of it and then were talked round into keeping it. And thank God they did because, you know, it's such a popular tourist attraction. But mm-hmm. he built these figures so they would be like a bicycle armature, like a bike wheel or something underneath it. And then he'd build up the cement and sand over the top of it. And then they'd be turned into people. So some of them might have mosaic, broken bits of crockery, mosaiced all over them with faces. And then he put eyes and maybe put a bit of shell in the eye. And then some of them are known as like the bangle ladies. So he'd find discarded bangles and broken bits of bangle and cover them in all these brightly coloured bits of broken bangle. And there'd be like one next to the other, next to the other. And there'd be like rows and rows of these people, and there's monkeys that he used to do as well. And then after a while, the Nek Chand Foundation was set up, and the Nek Chand Foundation allowed it so that volunteers could go over and help support Nek Chand as he got older to kind of finish building the rock garden and fix some of the broken pieces there. So there's like these huge, massive, you know, rock mounds with like waterfalls over the top of them.
Yes,
there's like swings hanging off things, you know, massive swings for humans to kind of hang off. It just looks, I mean, I've never been, I really want to go, but it just looks like the most amazing place. So again, that's known as an outsider environment. When he died, he was really celebrated.
So you have his work.
I have his work now. Unfortunately, most of his work is in the rock garden. So the pieces that came out were pieces that were like surplus to, you know, ones he created when he was there. So there's not actually that many on the market to be sold. So some might have come out and gone to an exhibition. I think at one point they couldn't afford to send Nek Chand's people couldn't afford to bring them back to India. So I think some of those ones then came onto the market because there was nowhere for them to go. But they're just incredible, amazing pieces that are very simple but bring so much joy when you look at them.
Yeah, and it's also such a commitment because it was such a large-scale sort of vision.
And for so many years with nobody knowing he was doing it. So, you know,
how did he do it? How did he get away with not being
discovered? I don't understand how no one found him for 18 years and he'd be like wheeling all this stuff and wheelbarrows around.
There's got to be a movie in that. Someone's got to play that. That's like... That's an incredible role for someone.
Definitely.
It's like the guy in Islington, the mole man, you know, that Sue Webster bought and David Ajay, the architect, renovated the house, but he sort of dug
under the ground, didn't
and it? Then did drawings and things on the walls. And I think Sue Webster has actually like preserved it all these tunnels and things. And
oh,
I think one
God.
Day a bus drove over the road or something and there was a huge hole in the road. So because he'd been digging so much underground. So these
wow.
stories do happen. And it also makes me think about that Jerry's Pompeii, you know, that flat
yeah,
that was in
West
Park
in London.
Last year.
Yeah.
Did that get saved? That got saved, didn't it?
I think it got saved, yeah. I think he had enough money found to save it. Mm. Yeah.
Oh, that's good.
But there's loads of little random places in London. There's Stephen Wright. Have you ever been to Stephen Wright's house? The House of Dreams in East Dulwich?
No.
Oh, my God, you need to Google it. He opens his house maybe like 8 to 10 times a year. It's just a house on a street in East Dulwich. And the ground floor of his house is just covered. I mean, I don't want to tell you too much because I want you to Google it and see the pictures, but it's Stephen Wright with a W of Wright, House of Dreams. And I think when he passes away, I believe the National Trust is taking it over.
Wow.
Mm. Is it all glitter? Is that what I'm imagining?
There's like bottle caps and everything and mosaic things.
It's
incredible. And he makes these incredible sculptures inside it. But people go round to his house and donate things. So I remember he told me someone's mum or something died and he had like 15 pairs of her glasses. And so he took all these glasses round to Stephen and then Stephen's built them into the wall there or something. And so this man goes round there to like visit his mum's glasses as though it's kind of like a bit of a shrine. So there's all these things that people have donated that were things of people's they know, and he builds them into this kind of incredible space that he's got. And then if you go upstairs, you're not allowed to go upstairs, but upstairs in his house, it's like minimal white walls, like complete opposite to what's going on downstairs. It's amazing.
The two sides of his brain are like,
amazing.
There's like a calmness and a, yeah, wow.
But you should, yeah, he opens his house to the public like maybe 8 times a year or something. And you pay to go and visit this, you know, incredible place that he's created. Amazing.
Well, thank you so much. Inspiring. This has been such a wonderful hour and a half together. I have loved every minute. And I really hope we get
good.
To do this again sometime. You know what? We should all go to India and make a TV show. About
yeah, totally.
Yes.
Yeah, that would be
That's
so good.
That's a really good idea.
Yeah.
You
yeah,
find the money, really I'll come with
talk
you.
Art special. Yeah, big time. And I really hope you get to come to Margate and we can go and see that show together.
Oh, yeah, as soon as I can get down there, I'm totally coming down there. Definitely. I watched
Amazing.
The online tour, which wasn't quite the same.
No.
Wonderful.
No. Well,
thank
you
so much,
Jen. So
Jennifer
you're
Gilbert,
on,
we love you.
You're on Instagram, Jennifer Lawrence Gallery. Anyone listening? And
Lauren.
All images we talked about today.
Jennifer Lawrence.
Sorry. Here we go. You're not Jennifer Lawrence, I'm thinking of the movie star. You're on the at Jennifer Lauren Gallery on Instagram. And then for everything else we're talking about, please go to the at Talk Art page on Instagram and at Talk Art Podcast on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
Right, Rob?
Wonderful. Yep. Well, and do we know your handle?
It's at @J_L_Gallery.
Great.
Got it. Brilliant.
Thanks for listening, everyone. We will be
Thank
back
so
very
much,
soon. Jennifer, that's been
Cheers,
amazing.
Jen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. We'll be back
Bye.
Soon.
Bye.
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 You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diament and Russell Tovey. Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in this episode. Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever you get your podcasts.